This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to tackle an issue that I think is of great interest. It's an issue that has to do with inheritance, and we have talked previously about genetic inheritance. To some extent, we are the sum total of our genes. Our chromosomes may dictate many aspects of our physical health and even our behavior, but we're going to look at a very interesting twist on our genetic endowment. Today's guest is Mark Wolin. He's author of It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. And Mark is a leading expert on inherited family trauma. He's the director of the Family Constellation Institute in San Francisco. And he trains clinicians and treats people struggling with depression, anxiety, panic disorder, and a wide variety of symptoms and conditions. He has taught at the University of Pittsburgh, the Western Psychiatric Institute, Kripalu, the Omega Institute, New York Open Center, and his articles have appeared in Psychology Today and Mind Body Green and many other venues. And he's even a published poet. Boy, this is a real claim to fame. Your poetry has been published in The New Yorker, so kudos to you, Mark. That's quite a distinction. You're multidimensional guy. Let's start with a discussion of the proposition here, because you know, we know about genes, and genes are fixed, we think, and they may account for certain aspects of our moods, our behaviors, our susceptibility to both physical and mental disorders. But there's some new research that really caught my attention. That's one of the reasons I invited you on this program, because you're one of the best people to articulate this new research, which suggests that previous trauma that's intergenerational can be inherited. So it's as if something happens to your grandmother, and somehow this can actually be part of your own inheritance, both, you know, certainly through family transmission, through maybe some of the emotional attitudes that were imparted to your parents by their parents. But this actually may be imprinted on our genes in a certain way. Am I overstating the case?
No, it's quite clear. And talking about our grandmom, if the trauma happened to her, she can be changed by this trauma. Chemical change takes place in her DNA, and this can change how her genes function, and that includes what we inherited, what our mom or dad will inherit, what we can inherit. Technically, after this trauma, a chemical tag or a chemical signal will attach to the DNA, and it'll tell the cell to use or ignore a certain gene, and then the way the genes are affected can change how we act or feel. For example, if grandma had a trauma, we can be similarly reactive to situations to her original trauma, so we can deal with it better. I mean, that's ultimately the goal of the gene changes, or this alteration is to prepare the organism, the person, the child, to deal with happened in a more cogent way, and then this can be transmitted to our children. So if this grandmother of ours, let's say she's from a war-torn country, she can pass forward a skill set, of sharper reflexes or quicker reaction times to help us survive the trauma that she experienced. The problem is we could inherit a stress response with the dials set to 10, prepared for this war that didn't happen to us.
You're right.
And then
of course, we have such a tragic scenario in the modern world where we have a lot of refugees, a lot of people exposed to devastating war circumstances. We have modern generations who are the descendants, say, of Holocaust survivors. So there are profound implications of this.
Absolutely. And when we're reacting to the stressors of a parent, for example, that can have a ill effect on our bodies, and these gene changes can, the science is showing us, can transfer for three generations. They can be observed.
And that it actually goes back to the biblical saying, that something to the effect of the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children unto the third generation. I think I'm translating a little bit liberally here, but isn't that an old saying?
I quote that in my book, Numbers. I think it's Numbers 14:18, mm-hmm. has a passage like that, and now science has caught up, or vice versa. Scientists, they've long suspected something like this was happening, but it wasn't until about 10 years ago that a neuroscientist out of Mount Sinai Medical named Rachel Yehuda discovered that the children of Holocaust survivors shared the same trauma symptoms, specifically the low levels of cortisol. That's the stress hormone that gets us back to normal after a stressful event. And she found a similar pattern in children born to pregnant mothers who were at or near the World Trade Center when it was attacked during 9/11. And they too had similar symptoms. In fact, 16 different genetic markers. And then last year, she found this tremendous, she found that survivors and their children shared the same exact gene changes in the same exact region of the same gene, technically the FBP5 gene, which really suggests that these traumas are heritable.
Well, you know, and this kind of takes me back to college biology, where we studied evolution. And these notions that you're now expressing were considered really taboo. They really flew in the face of our modern concept of evolution, which is based on Darwin. Darwin had a rival whose name was Lamarck. And Lamarckianism has actually become synonymous with a, you know, form of quackery or like a real wrong turn in science. And if I can sum it up, maybe you can do a better job. It was thought that giraffes might have gotten longer and longer necks because their ancestors had to stretch more to get up to the trees. And with each successive effort at stretching, it sent a signal to their, whatever, their genes, to have a longer stretch. And therefore they got longer necks. And of course, Darwin demolished this theory and said, well, the ones with short necks just died off and the ones with long necks, survived. And that's called natural selection. Right?
Well, see, I'm aware of lots of studies with mice and rats. I'm not aware of this, this about giraffes, but it's fascinating. I mean, it would make sense that the adaptive changes, but what I can speak to, these patterns, we can see them for two generations in humans. But with mice, because they share a similar genetic makeup to humans, let's say if we have something like 30,000 genes, mice have 99% of a similar genetic makeup. So what would that be? 29,700 genes approximately similar to humans. So this is why they can do these studies. And in one study at Emory Medical in Atlanta, they took male mice and they made them afraid of a particular scent, a cherry blossom scent. So they shocked the mice every time the mice would experience the smell. And then they observed these blood and brain and sperm changes. In fact, in the brain itself, as we're talking about these adaptations, there were enlarged areas where there would be greater amounts of the smell receptors to detect this scent at a lesser concentration, thus protecting them. If I can detect it as a mouse sooner, then I have more of a inherent innate protective device. So they take the sperm and they impregnate females that weren't shocked. And then they take the sperm again, or they take the progeny, the pups in the second and third generation, and they see that these mice were jumpy and jittery, basically freaking out without ever having been shocked, just wow. by smelling the smell of the cherry blossom. In other words, they inherit the stress response without directly experiencing the trauma. So like the giraffes, they had this adaptation in the brain. They had these enlarged areas where greater smell receptors existed. So that I can speak to.
Right.
All these studies, I have to read so many studies about mice and rats for this book. You know, we can show it in two generations in humans, but we'd be waiting a very long time for that third generation, because a generation in humans, what, 15, 20 years, where a generation in mice is 12 to 20 weeks.
Well,
so they can do these.
Yeah, I was citing that giraffe example as an example of what became a scientific heresy, this notion that because of previous generations striving to do something or adapting to something, that was transferred somehow. But now we're overturning that dogma. There's also a guy, I don't know, maybe you're familiar with him in studying evolution, Lysenko, who was a Russian scientist who, he was around in the Stalin era, and he posited that if you took Russian wheat from the wheat belt and you put it into, the Arctic regions, that eventually it would learn somehow to survive in the Arctic regions. And then, you would have a whole new, region to cultivate, that would open up new vistas of agricultural productivity. Unfortunately, Stalin put a bet on Lysenko science, and it failed miserably. And then, you know, that's been discredited. But the answer may lie somewhere in between, you know, between just pure classic Darwinian natural selection and this notion that we have a certain plasticity of our genes that can be shaped. And I guess the buzzword for that is epigenetics. Could you speak to the issue of epigenetics? You alluded to it earlier. It means that we can switch on and switch off certain genes by virtue of environmental factors.
Right. An environmental factor, a trauma, is somehow held in the awareness of the cell, in the gene, and it can be transmitted to the next generation. And it's a fascinating study, and I keep up on these studies. And what's interesting is that, you know, they can actually show that maybe this whole reach only can extend three generations. There's research coming out of the Brain Institute at the University of Zurich where they've traumatized male mice by repeatedly separating them from their mother, from the mothers. And, you know, it's funny, they only did it. It's such a, what we would consider a mild trauma. They separated the mice for only 3 hours a day for the first 2 weeks of life. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then these mice exhibited symptoms which would be similar to what we call depression in humans. And then again, the pups in the second, the third generation, again, the same trauma symptoms, despite never having experienced this trauma themselves. And the mechanism here where the researchers found abnormally high numbers of small microRNA, non-coding RNA, the genetic material that regulates gene expression in the blood and brain. Well, here's the clincher. Although the mice in the third generation expressed the same symptoms as their fathers and their grandfathers, in that third generation, the elevated numbers of the microRNAs were not detected in the blood and the brain, which led the researchers to speculate that a traumatic event can express for three generations, but maybe not beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And what's even crazier about that study is some of the male mice did not exhibit the symptoms themselves, but appeared to epigenetically transmit it to their female offspring.
Mm, okay. So they carried the adaptation, but did not express it. And it was available as potentially an evolutionarily adaptive tool, that can maybe gird the future generations against stressful circumstances.
Exactly. Exactly. So these changes are ultimately for the betterment of the species, to prepare prepare our children for dealing with the trauma, because the trauma affected the way in which our genes expressed. They turned on, they turned off, they turned up, they turned down. And in this sense, we would have a built-in protective adaptive mechanism to help us survive, but it's not always protective when our body remains on high alert, or we are experiencing symptoms or behaviors or physiologic changes of trauma, and there's no trauma in sight. It can be harmful on the body.
Indeed.
Both psychologically, physically.
To some extent, this sounds almost a little fatalistic, like, okay, you know, through no fault of your own, due to no circumstances during your own lifetime, you may be wired to be more anxious, to be potentially more depressed, or to pump out high levels of stress hormones at the slightest instigation because of something that your grandparent experienced.
And this is why I wrote the book.
Okay.
Because we can do something about it.
Great. Okay. So how does this manifest in your psychological work? You obviously see descendants of people who may have been exposed to trauma. You can sometimes identify that through a comprehensive history. What then?
Okay, so when I see the effects of trauma, whether it's our trauma, we had a break in the bond or an early separation. We were from our mother. We were in an incubator. We were given away at birth. There was an event, a trauma, whether it's ours or whether it's heritable, it's not always so discernible as to where it comes until we look at the family history. So what I do is I teach people how to listen for their trauma language, how to decipher this language of trauma that we all carry, and then how to link where this language originated. Sometimes this language originates in our trauma, and sometimes, I'll talk about some cases, it originates in trauma's past. One of the cases I talk about in the book is a woman who, she was going to take her life. And I asked her how she planned to do that. And listen to this trauma language, Ron. Mm-hmm. She said, I plan to vaporize myself.
Hmm.
And it's unusual.
Unusual terminology.
What does that mean, right?
Yeah, right.
So I said, so tell me more how you plan to do that. And she said, well, my brother, he works at the steel mill, and I'm able to get in to visit, and then I'm going to leap into one of those vats of molten steel. And listen to this language, and my body will incinerate within seconds.
Hmm.
So, you know, when you look at a patient, a client, in the context of his or her life experience, and you're hearing things that don't belong, that are out of context, like these symptoms, this language, this feeling of wanting to die, it didn't exist in her childhood. So I asked her to tell me about her family. When I heard vaporize and incinerate, I'm hearing the words Holocaust, I'm hearing burn, I'm hearing fire. So as I fished around and asked her questions, I said, how about the Holocaust? Anybody in your family ever involved or experienced or survived? She said, well, my grandmother, before she became Catholic, she was a Jew, and she lived in Poland during the war, but then she married my Catholic grandmother, and she became Catholic. I said, back up. What happened to her during the war? She said, oh, her whole family died in the ovens of Auschwitz, but we were never allowed to talk about it.
Wow, okay.
And then you have a connection, this wanting to die. Who died? Who wanted to die? If the grandmother lost her mother, her father, and her siblings, and is the only survivor, does she not carry a form of survivor guilt? When we can't talk about the dead in our family, all those who died, are we not connected in some way? You know, I have so many cases like this where people, how do you tell? And people ask me, Mark, are there signs? And, you know, there are signs. yes, we can be born with a depression or an anxiety or behavior or symptom that's out of context. But also, we might experience a fear or an anxiety or a symptom that strikes suddenly when we reach a certain age or hit a certain milestone in our life. Ron, for example, we go to get married. I mean, everything's okay, but now we're married and something tips the scales. Or we go to have a child. Or we get rejected by a partner, and then something brings up that early rejection with our mom, and we move to a new place. I one time worked with a woman who was consumed with anxiety as soon as she became a new mother. Never had anxiety her whole life. Mm-hmm. But now that she's pregnant, she has this horrific fear that she's going to harm her baby. So the obvious question, did you ever harm a baby? No. Did you ever get pregnant? No. Did anyone in your family ever harm a baby? No. And then she says, oh my goodness. My grandmother, when she was a young woman, lit a candle and the curtains caught on fire. The house caught on fire. Her baby was, her newborn was upstairs sleeping. Mm-hmm. She could not get her baby out. Mm-hmm. And the baby died. But we're never allowed to talk about it. You never mentioned this. Mm-hmm. In that moment, she made this profound connection that when she got pregnant, that she too had this language of her grandmother's experience that she could harm her baby, her new baby.
Hmm. And it was both, it's probably imparted in two ways. One is through the culture of the family, the family lore, the conversation, or the sometimes conscious or unconscious communication. That's one way. But you're saying that at some level, this is literally locked into DNA inheritance, that there is a certain real physiological basis for some of these things.
Embryologists have known for more than 100 years that we share the same biological environment, literally the same womb as our grandmother. So the cell line stops dividing in the female egg. And when our mother is 5 months in gestation, in other words, when our mother's a 5-month-old fetus inside our grandmother, the egg that will one day be you, be me, is also resides in that womb, our mother's womb and our grandmother's womb. That's another speculative way. Mm-hmm. Then we've got the work of Bruce Lipton, who talks about the emotions of the parents. The mother can be communicated through the blood-borne barrier through the placenta, mm-hmm. and can affect a genetic expression. Then we have epigenetics, this new study in the last 10 years showing us that these traumas are heritable.
Right.
So, there's everything. And epigenetics is one ingredient in the soup, but there's a lot of soup there.
There's even another pathway that I just became aware of, which has to do with the microbiome. And we know that the microbiome responds to stressors. You could literally change the flora in your gastrointestinal tract. And we know, of course, that the microbiome, to some extent, is inherited as the baby goes through the birth passage. They pick up the vaginal flora from mom, which may be affected by emotions. And then we have another source of transmission that's outside our DNA that may be within our guts. So that's yet another mechanism by which these things can be transmitted.
Absolutely. And we keep seeing more studies each day alerting us to the fact that our traumas or our trauma symptoms might not have originated with us, which is why I wrote that book. It didn't start with you.
Well, that's a good point at which to pause, because we've laid the groundwork for a fascinating discussion. The book is It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are. And the important part of this book that we're going to tackle in part two, please stay with us, is how to end the cycle. We're going to provide you with some practical suggestions how not to perpetuate this cycle of inherited family trauma and how to extinguish it. Our guest is Mark Wallin, the author of It Didn't Start With You. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.